All right, folks, so welcome, all of you. My name is Jennifer Gray. I'm one of the lecturers here at MoMA. This is my colleague and friend, Hyun-tae Young, and the topic for today, for today's talk, basically, we're hoping to have kind of a dialogue. We're calling it Sign Languages, Architecture, Popular Culture, and Communication. So I think even just from this, you know, shot I put up here for the opening shot, you can get a sense of the kind of built environments that we're going to be talking about. And basically, where I got this image, it's a picture taken from a 1972 book written by Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown called Learning from Las Vegas, and I'll talk more about that project as we get going here, but they essentially analyze the built environment of the Strip in Las Vegas and come to the realization that contemporary vernacular architecture in the 1960s and 1970s had more to do with an architecture of symbolism and communication, not so much about iconic buildings, per se. It was more about the way they communicate through these signs. So we'll talk more about that, but just generally speaking, it'll be popular culture, communication, and architecture. On that note, how we're going to try and run the program is I'm going to give some kind of basic overview of this sort of semiotic theory of architecture and go through a few examples. And then Hyun-tae is going to go through and give some more examples from earlier in the 20th century after I do my presentation. But in the spirit of communication, we're hoping that we will talk with each other about some of these ideas, but also hopefully rope you all into some of the dialogue. So I'm going to kind of just lay out some information, and hopefully we can have you know, a conversation, essentially. So, all right. So
we're gonna... I'll be sitting here. Until right
there. You can sit there if you want. Although if you talk, you have to talk. Well, the microphone can probably pick you up there. It'll be fine. All right, so to give you a little bit of background, this is from 1972, Learning from Las Vegas, the Forgotten Symbolism of Architectural Form. As I mentioned, Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown wrote this. Actually, the Learning from Las Vegas project is a series of projects. So they had first gone there in 1968 to study Las Vegas. It was a Yale architecture studio project in the fall of 1968. They published a large book in 1972, which is a very large kind of format book with these super graphics, essentially. And they republished a smaller version that was more affordable, like lightweight, more portable, essentially, in 1977. So the Learning from Las Vegas, it's not a single book. It's an entire kind of project that they embarked upon for, I guess, almost a decade, actually, at this point. So it's really become kind of a turning point in terms of architectural history towards an architecture that is open and amenable to this type of just casual, impromptu, informal, commercial vernacular, as they call it. In terms of how we can read the built environment as signs, we were just discussing the complexity and ambiguity of these signs right here. We've got, I mean, maybe you all can even tell me, what are some of the signs that you see in here? There's the obvious one. Oops, see, I always do that. I said here. We've got a gigantic cowboy standing front and center, and I'm assuming he's holding some sort of tire rims because he's standing in front of an auto body sign of some kind. Why the cowboy? This is Las Vegas, so it might speak sort of, you know, broadly about the West or something like this. To the left behind him, we have a sign for a casino, the Aladdin Casino, which just even in sort of the, you know, design of the actual sign, but of course the name today, we might reference it to movies or something, is the movie Aladdin, but, you know, it's bringing something of like the exotic or something into the scene, even though the cowboy here front and center is more of the local scene. So you have this kind of mashup of different references through the signs. And I think one thing that they're very interested in is the fact that you have this kind of messy, ambiguous, complex reading of multiple signs. And just to explain a little bit about how the theory of signs works in architecture, the idea that architecture can communicate something or it's a symbol of larger ideas, this is widespread. So even though we have Learning from Las Vegas in 1972, the idea that architecture communicates is not new per se. So we'll show you some older stuff later on, but the idea that you could really read them almost literally as kind of text is very popular by the late 60s and 1970s, and essentially the theory of signs is, and there's multiple, you know, linguists that deal with this kind of stuff, we don't have to necessarily go into all the details, but the theory of signs basically looks at how one thing symbolizes another concept, and the thing, the signifier it's called, can be a word, it can be a drawing, it can be a building, it can be an artwork. So if I have the word apple, for example, those are random symbols that we commonly agree stand for the actual apple that we take a bite out of, right? So there's a signifier, which is the thing that signifies an actual object. Other people would include a third part to that relationship, the referent it's called. So you've got a signifier, the word. You've got the concept it signifiers, the idea of apple. And then you have an actual apple, which is like a physical object. So point being, there's a little bit of, you know, variances in terms of these different theories. But, you know, when you look at something like that Aladdin sign, on one level, it just explicitly, it is a sign. It's not a metaphorical sign. It literally is a sign that tells you that's a casino. It's called Aladdin. But it also, you know, calls to mind these associations about maybe exotic culture or something like this, because it's the word Aladdin, it's the shape of the signs, this kind of thing. So it's a broader concept of meanings and associations that we read from that sign that are more intuitive. It's not necessarily a direct reading of the sign. It's both, is my point. It's a direct reading and it's this kind of intuitive reading. So it's this type of idea that architecture communicates literally in terms of a sign, but also in terms of these broader associations that we make between them. So I wanted to kind of backtrack a little bit and give you some context about why this theory of signs and reading architecture as text and this embrace of just informal commercial vernacular happens in the late 1960s and 1970s. And part of it has to do with the perceived failure of iconic modernism that happens at this time. And I just brought in two iconic images, basically, of the failure of modernism that's frequently republished in, journals and books on postmodern architecture. On the right-hand side, I'm showing you a very well-publicized image of the demolition of Pruitt-Igoe, which is a now infamous housing public housing project, basically. It was built in 1955 in St. Louis, Missouri, by the same architect that did the Yamasaki, that did the World Trade Center, actually. This is an earlier project of his. But essentially, it's just one of these Title I public housing projects. The whole point is it was these huge towers surrounded by kind of parkland, and the idea is it would really improve the lives of the poverty-stricken people that were living in this public housing project. In the span of less than 20 years, oh, I'm sorry, it's cut off there, it's 1972 is when it was demolished. The project had gone from being literally sort of a model public housing project, was its initial intention, to just, it just went downhill so quickly to become like a den of crime and graffiti, and just the buildings were falling apart, and even the people in the public housing program would refuse to move into there because it was so dangerous. So in less than two decades, it just became like the worst kind of slum, and they demolished it. So it more than other modern buildings, perhaps, came to symbolize just the failure of the modern project, not just the architecture, but the social project, that you could use architecture to improve society. It came to symbolize the failure of it, I think precisely because it is exploded, right? It's not just a kind of the ball and chain sort of hitting it there, but the image is just so compelling because it literally is just crumbling to the ground in kind of a ball of flames. They didn't demolish the whole thing this way, by the way, I should say, too. They did a trial. They demolished like four or five buildings in the center of the complex with this massive explosion. The media, of course, lined up to take their picture. So it's another way that architecture can communicate, even through pictures. It's not even the building per se. It's the media documentation of them being exploded that became their most iconic image, interestingly, not the buildings as they were built. They ended up taking the rest of it down more conventionally. But nonetheless, it's been recycled in the literature as this, you know, end of modernism. On the left-hand side, I'm showing you a photo collage by Stanley Tigerman called The Titanic from 1978. And I don't know if you all can recognize the building. It's good guess. It's Crown Hall. So it's a Mies van der Rohe, and actually I brought in just a couple of images here so we can sort of get some context. I'll go back to that. On the upper left-hand side here, this is Mies van der Rohe's Crown Hall. So it's the architecture school on the Illinois Institute of Technology's campus, IIT, which is outside of Chicago. And it's just one of his kind of, he designed the whole campus. And actually, if you get a chance, it's worth going out there to see them. But as most of us know, his architectural vocabulary, for the most part, consisted of these glass and steel kind of boxes. And this one is more of kind of a sort of almost like space frame type structure. I just brought in a New York iconic image of Mies van der Rohe, just since we're all here in New York, but you might recognize the Seagram building. It's just at 53rd and Park down the street. Again, kind of glass and steel box, but he's very well known for signifying or expressing the structural system or the construction system on the exterior. So, and you can see it here, but this is one of the Seagram building's a more iconic building, and the Farnsworth House does this as well. These I-beams that you see on the facade, they're actually just welded all onto the facade. These are not structural. They make the curtain wall more rigid, but they're not actually really structural. What they are is a symbol of the structural system. So these aren't holding up the building. They're a symbol of what's holding up the building. And moreover, they're bronze. So they're thinner than actual steel. They're more expensive than actual steel. There's an elaborate cleaning process that has to go on constantly to keep them from turning green. So it's not actually functional in the sense of being expedient or economical or something like this. He's really interested in expressing the structure. So, but he becomes known for this type of architecture. And unfortunately, what happens by the time we get Tigerman doing the Titanic here, where he's got Crown Hall, the, you know, emblem of Miesian modernism, less is more, right? And what is it doing? It's sinking like the Titanic into Lake Michigan. This is Lake Michigan because IIT is, you know, outside Chicago. So he's trying to say something about the death of this kind of modernism. And I think in this case, what Tigerman's indicating is less the death of the social project, but also the death of the visual project, that this idea of a minimalist, less is more, glass and steel modernism that at one point maybe spoke to modernity, that unfortunately it does not speak maybe to mass culture, that not everyone really reads these buildings in the way that an architecture culture might. And the fact that I can show you Crown Hall, an office building here, right, Seagram Building, the Farnsworth House is a home, they're all done in the same architectural vocabulary. It's almost unreadable as to which one's a home versus, and I have the Farnsworth in here, I'll get to it later, but, you know, you almost can't read which one is home and which one is office and which one's an architecture school. They all use the same vocabulary. So, essentially, by the late 60s and 70s, there's kind of an exhaustion over this, that the glass box, in fact, as it comes to be called, is mute. It's not capable of being read or being legible or speaking to a broad audience. So, it's this kind of cluster of events, the failure of the social project, the kind of boredom or maybe overproduction of the aesthetic project that creates this atmosphere where architects are turning towards the everyday commercial vernacular environment and trying to read this instead. So this is kind of just the background. Okay, so here's just some images from Learning from Las Vegas. Caesar's Palace on the left-hand side, the Flamingo on the right-hand side, and I just wanted to lay out a couple of their major precepts that they put forth in this book. The first is that they take as their starting point just the existing conditions of the built environment versus the revolutionary tendencies of high modernism, if we want to call it that. The Pruitt-Igoe complex, for example, they did a slum clearance project. They raised what was there, and they built these towers instead, and the idea is that it would reform the people and reform the environment, but that's not taking the existing environment for its own sake. It's just creating an entirely new environment. So it's very revolutionary that you're putting something entirely new in its place. They say that actually the existing environment's kind of okay. As they phrase it, Main Street is almost all right, or they say billboards are almost all right. Instead of trying to change it, why don't we look at what's out there in the actual vernacular and try and learn from it? We don't necessarily have to redo it constantly. The other is they posit that in a, you know, post-war world dominated by highways and strip malls and strip architecture and suburban housing and this kind of thing, that architecture by this point, by the late 60s and 70s, is no longer about architectural forms in space. It's about symbols in space. That architecture has to be about communication, not about beautiful forms that you have to be up close to see. And the reason being is because increasingly people only see the built environment across vast distances, the highway, the parking lot, this kind of thing, at high speeds because they're moving in a car. And so you don't have the time and the intimacy to actually see the details of something like, to go back to the Mies here, to see the details of these I-beams, right? This requires you to go close to the building, so you don't actually see this from the car. And so their argument is that in this new contemporary culture, that architecture has to focus more on communication and symbols, not necessarily on architectural form, per se, the way that the earlier models, earlier moderns did. And just to show you a few more examples of this kind of thing, they're the two types of architecture that they posit here to elaborate on their theory. They call one of them the decorated shed, which they're in favor of, and the other the duck architecture. And just to show you, this is another image on the left-hand side from Learning from Las Vegas, but they argue that among all this kind of urban or suburban sprawl, as we might call it, that you do have signs in here. You do have these signifiers that tell you what's going on. And increasingly, and you also have modulators of space. So things like, you know, the stoplights, we've got the lighting posts here, that these help to organize the space, even though we kind of look at them as clutter or, you know, noise or something in the built environment, they do help to move you through space, in fact. And we use them all the time. If you drive on a highway, you're often getting off on some clover leaf where you're going right to go left, and you rely entirely on these signs, as a matter of fact. So they're just kind of pointing that out, that even though architects and artists, we might like to look at this as sort of, you know, again, clutter or noise or something that needs to be cleaned up, that for everyday people in everyday life, you rely on these constantly, that this is a major factor in the built environment. And what they start noticing is that with the car, increasingly the sign of the architecture is not attached to the building because it has to be next to the road. So, I mean, we all know this, right? You drive down the Walmart sign, well, there's one on the Walmart shed, but there's a Walmart sign by the road advertising that there's a Walmart there. So we have all these signs here telling you what is behind the parking lots that, of course, is a little bit further away from the road. So they call this phenomenon the decorated shed, and here's just their little diagram of it, where you've got the massive sign, Eats, right? Restaurant here. You can see that clearly from the highway. The architecture itself doesn't need to be anything. And they call it the decorated shed. That's really just often a one-story kind of shed architecture. It's anonymous. It's kind of banal. There's really no detail put into the architecture per se. It's just a warehouse of sorts, which they argue is actually an extremely efficient type of architecture, especially because it's good for air conditioning. They mentioned this multiple times. times. You know, in the text here, I think air conditioning maybe at that time was not quite as powerful as it is now, perhaps. But that low rise, these kind of large span, but low rise buildings is easier for air conditioning. You don't necessarily need a lot of windows. They point that out because electric lighting is at the point where you can totally artificially light the interior. So you don't need to have all the glass and steel and this kind of thing. You don't necessarily need it. And because it's a warehouse, it's economical, it's expedient, and it's subdividable, right? On the inside, you can sort of move the shelves wherever you want. You can put two stores in there. It's a flexible type space as well. So usually there's a sign on the shed, but oftentimes the sign by the road is just as elaborate, if not more elaborate, than the one on the architecture. So they call this the new commercial vernacular, that is this architecture of communication. It's not an architecture of form, so the sign is more important. Now they juxtapose this with another type of roadside architecture that they call the duck, which you see up here. And I brought in the actual duck. There is a duck in Long Island. It's been moved. I can't remember where it moved now. But and this is actually from the 30s, I believe. But essentially, the duck makes two references. How they use it here, they borrow this image from a text called God's Own Junkyard. But essentially, the original duck from the 30s, it was a type of architecture called mimetic roadside architecture. And you would see it a lot in the 30s and 40s. And this is before the interstate, though, which changed. The highway is not the interstate. So on the highway, okay, you're going 50 miles an hour maybe, or 45 miles an hour, but it's not as big, the spaces are not as vast, and you're not moving at high of a speed. So you could have this mimetic roadside architecture like the duck. It clearly says something to you. This was the sign, if you want to call it that, of a duck farm. Long Island actually at one point was really famous for picking ducks, raising them to sell to restaurants and that kind of thing. And in the duck building that you see here, it was sort of, they would sell some food products and this kind of thing. Now, obviously, you know it's something to do with ducks or buying duck food, or, you know, there's a duck farm there. So it symbolizes all of that clearly from the road, because the building itself is the symbol. You don't have a sign attached to it. The building is the sign. This is the duck. The problem with duck architecture, as you can imagine, is it's spatially very restrictive. I mean, this is a small space. You know, you enter through the chest here. I think there's another door out the back. It's not very adaptable, right? Because it's a sculpture, it's not amenable to kind of subdivision or adding on and this kind of stuff. So how they position this is that the form, the symbol, dominates over program or space or structure or anything like this. It actually kind of is almost like a tyranny over the program. So while it's readable, it's not necessarily expedient and economical and this kind of thing. So they're kind of against the duck, but I think it's interesting they chose it, because originally this mimetic roadside architecture was one of communication, but in the text they sort of argue against it. And I just brought in this big donut drive-in here, just another example. This would be kind of like a duck and a shed, because the building is not the donut, it's just a gigantic donut put on top of the shed. But think of something like if you have a hot dog stand in the shape of a wiener. You know, it's like this is the mimetic roadside architecture. So they call this duck architecture, and their main point is that this type of architecture of communication, of signs, a decorated shed, that this is more relevant for contemporary society in the 60s and early 1970s. And I just wanted to bring in a McDonald's architecture here just to point out that there is this transition between something like a duck to the decorated shed, and this is the first McDonald's. And now, of course, we know McDonald's, right? The Golden Arches, this kind of thing. But early on, the parabolic arches were actually part of the building, so you can see how the two arches are part of the McDonald's building. There's actually only one on the sign. They haven't doubled them yet, but it basically evolved to become the double arches that we know of, that usually is only in the sign. The building's are maybe vaguely recognizable, or maybe it's like a rock and roll McDonald's or whatever it is, but it's the sign. And in fact, on the commercials now on television, I'll talk about branding in a moment, all you need to see are the arches. You don't even need the word McDonald's any longer. So in the course of, you know, 50 years, we've gone from having the sign be part of the architecture to having it be only the sign, to having the words of the sign are not even necessary. The image alone is enough to convey the message. So it's a process of evolution, is my point. It's not just there's only ducks and only decorated sheds. We go through a few iterations. And just to kind of give you one more example here, and then we'll get into some more discussion. In the textbook, they propose that architects should learn from Las Vegas that Main Street's kind of okay. We should take away from this, you know, commercial vernacular and design architecture that's just more ordinary and conventional, that speaks to everyday life and everyday people, and not make these monumental, heroic, they call them, buildings. So they do this lengthy comparison between two projects. One is their own. On the right-hand side, I'm showing you Guild House. It's in Philadelphia, built during 1960 to 1965. And on the left-hand side, is Crawford Manor in New Haven, Connecticut, from around the same time period, early to mid-1960s. They chose these two examples because they are both housing for the elderly, so like assisted living type, or I guess not assisted living, but these sort of housing for the elderly. And so they wanted the programs to be the same, but they also chose to contrast them because they argued that Rudolph's Crawford Manor, this home for the elderly, that it's still in that tradition of heroic modernism that attempts to signify structure or, you know, some kind of monumentality, but it does not clearly speak to everyday people and the everyday life that people lead in these projects. They argued that, in contrast, the Guild House on the right-hand side is more relevant to everyday life and what people do. So to give you a few examples of their argument, the ornament on the right-hand side, I might have brought in a close-up. That might be a little easier to see. Essentially what they did when they built Guild House is they tried to have it just blend in with the surroundings. So it's just as tall as the buildings around it. It employs just, you know, an everyday, it's a concrete cast frame with brick curtain wall on the outside. They deliberately chose a dark brick to kind of match with like the soot-stained buildings. It's kind of a polluted area. It's in a working class kind of area. So they're not trying to have the building stand out. They're deliberately trying to have it blend in because it will be familiar to the everyday folks that live in that neighborhood and be readable in that sense. Crawford Manor, on the other hand, it's this monumental, it's beautiful, they say it's a good building by a great architect, but it's not necessarily fitting with the neighborhood. This is this kind of heroic, iconic modernism that's trying to stand out or be revolutionary in some way. Basically, the exterior of Crawford Manor, I mean, there's windows in it, but the main thing that you notice are the sculptural plastic quality of the balconies that articulate the facade. And these are not structural. They almost look as if they're structural. They look as if they're technologically advanced. But it's really about creating that kind of sculptural quality. So it conveys something, but it doesn't convey what we think it conveys. This building is also just a concrete frame building with the curtain wall. So it's not actually structurally more advanced. It actually is conventional in terms of its structure, but it looks somehow more technologically advanced. Moreover, it's not clear. I mean, what if I didn't tell you that was a home for the elderly, what would you think it is? Yeah, it could be an apartment building or like a college dormitory maybe or something. I mean, it could be anything almost. I mean, maybe not an office. There might not be enough windows, but it's not necessarily clear what it is per se. It could be almost anything. And this is what the Venturis mean by it's not readable to an everyday audience, an everyday context. If anything, what it references is more the history of architecture or the history of technology or the history of using the spaces in this way. Sorry, I can't hear what you're saying. What?
They're actually both sculptural, and Guild House is not just a one-story
shed. No. No, this isn't necessarily... the contrast is... Let me go forward to the... Sorry. Two parts about the sculptural. Are you talking about the antenna?
No, the form of massing of the building, it steps down.
It does. It kind of telescopes out. It telescopes out, actually. And the interior apartments are all these kind of these 1920s-style apartments where the rooms are different shapes and they actually change in level. So that is expressed on the outside, whereas in the Crawford Manor, what they would argue is that it just is uniform on the outside, right? There's no... You can't tell if one apartment is a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom. It's just that uniform. And they privilege, in a sense, the sculptural quality of the balconies over any kind of expression of what's going on the inside. Whereas a Guild House, you can tell that the apartments vary in size. It does have that telescoping quality. It's frankly proclaiming what it is. There's the super graphics with Guild House, right? Over, I mean, it looks maybe a little just commercial or kind of crass or something like this, but it clearly says what it is. In addition, it's kind of hard to see in the picture. That's why I thought maybe you were getting at. This is a sculptural quality. There's a gigantic antenna on the top up here. I don't know if you all can see this. It's a gold-plated, oversized antenna. And over what is placed over this arched window that you see here is the kind of recreation TV viewing room for the people in the housing complex. These are the apartments. And what he claim that they're trying to do is to just clearly express to everybody that the facts of everyday life for people living in this building, that they spend a lot of time watching TV in the rec room and they live in their apartments, and this is just kind of everyday life. It's not a heroic modernism, it's just an everyday kind of modernism. And to make it all the more vexing for, at their time, the, you know, modernists that they were sort of embattled against, it's not a functional antenna. The actual antenna is hidden somewhere behind the walls. It literally is just a sculpture, a symbol proclaiming what happens in there. And so the overall effect is that it does, they call it ugly and ordinary architecture, that which they take on as sort of a bonus, right? But critics, of course, said it's ugly and ordinary. Shouldn't we try and do something more heroic and monumental? But they said that this, they argued that this actually just speaks to everyday people more clearly and more legibly than something like Crawford Manor. They argue that Crawford Manor is a duck because it privileges the sculpturalness of the balconies, the articulation of light and void, over the program inside. So they argue it's kind of a duck, which I think that, and we can maybe talk about that. I think the jump from a mimetic roadside architecture to Crawford Manor is a little problematic because it skips too many steps. But they argue that the point there is it's illegible. It privileges form over what's happening on the inside. And in this case, it's more about accommodating in a direct and expedient way the actual lives that people lead, not trying to change them. For example, in the Crawford Manor, there's an elaborate library reading room that the elderly that live there are supposed to, you know, improve themselves and educate themselves in this library. And Venturi, on the other hand, frankly puts the TV room there just to kind of say, we're not here to change people. We're here to just accommodate their everyday needs. So I think that is, I think the jump from, they argue that the Crawford Manor is a duck, but I do think that's a little bit, you know, getting from one to the other takes a few more steps. A few other points just to point out, and then I'm going to get to a house and let you guys do some talking. Oops, sorry, the, I always do that. The forward button and the light button look the same. There's this massive column in the center here. This is the main entrance. How do you know it's the main entrance? I mean, there's a sign, but how else? Like materials. Yeah, it's in the front. It's got this kind of, it's white actually. It looks kind of yellow in the picture, but it's got this white glazed tile on the front, so it's clearly different from the rest of the building. It's like a glazed tile like you'd see in the subways or something like this. And they argue that the glazed tile, it's a nicer material. It kind of elevates the entrance and separates it from the rest of the building. But I think at the same time that this would be a tile that you might see in a subway or something like that, it speaks again just to the everyday built in. It's not marble, right? So it speaks kind of the everyday built environment. So this is the main entrance. It's also clearly proclaimed by Guildhall being written in the super graphics in the sign above, but they in a way undermine the monumentality of the entrance by putting this column right here because it bisects the doors into these two kind of small doors. Actually, they're not a monumental door, they're just kind of two entrances, like small entrances that you go into. So at times they kind of ironically play with these points. For example, the windows are all different sizes and it corresponds to the functions inside, but some of them on the far sides here, these are actually, most of them are just kind of off the shelf, but these are actually specially designed windows, double hung windows that are bigger than your average double hung window. And they argue that rather than using balconies to sculpturally mold the facade, we're simply using windows to punctuate the facade, right? Sort of an ordinary way that people would create variety essentially on the facade. But they do also use custom made ones that are bigger. So they appropriate the signs of everyday life, but they do often change them. For example, this kind of string course up here that unites these windows, you might notice that it unites them together, but never once does it actually intersect any window in a place that makes sense. Like, it doesn't go through the center, it doesn't go along the top, it hits them at weird points every time. And so he's offering something of, like, humor or irony, attempting to offer this in the building. And I wonder if, maybe we can chat about it, does the fact that he introduces these ironic elements that you have to kind of seek out, like the antenna, right? You have to know that that's a non-functioning antenna. You have to find the humor in that. You have to find the string courses that don't match up. Does that undermine his argument that this is readable by an everyday public? By introducing these ironies that you have to... Or maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it's a double-coded... I can read the irony because I'm trained in architectural history. An everyday person might just say it's a TV antenna, and so what? You can it is both those things, right? So it's irony and it's not. But I think the fact that he's making these ironic statements, in that sense, he's still speaking to an architectural elite at the same time that he's maybe speaking to a mass culture. But maybe that undermines his idea of the everyday, the ugly and ordinary for the everyday. Okay, here's one of his other houses that does this. This is the house for his mother, Vanna Venturi. 1959, 1962. What says home about this? Yeah, gabled roof, right? We always think a house has... In my housing classes, I always do this, like, draw a house, and the first thing everyone does is... Doot, doot, doot.
The chimney, the hearth.
Yeah, the hearth is kind of front and center. Weirdly, though, we have this void, right? So we've got the gabled roof, but it's broken. So we've got the sign of house, but at the same time, it's kind of ironic, right? There's something off about it, in a sense. The windows, again, are all different sizes, corresponding to the functions. We does not attempt to make them, you know, symmetrical or anything like this. On the right-hand side, these are over the kitchen counter, so it's nice to have a lot of light over the kitchen counter, but they're tall and they're above the countertop. You can see they're not, you know, floor-to-ceiling or anything like this. This is a bathroom window. It's a small porthole because you really don't want people looking in on you when you go to the bathroom. And this is the bedroom. So the sizes are just, they're only there because of the program inside. There's no attempt to make them uniform so the form looks nice. It's about the program inside. I think probably the most domestic aspect is Vanna, this is his mother, sitting there. And what do we have next to her? Yeah, it's just a little, like just a little flower pot. You would get the thing at Home Depot, you'd plant the geranium in there. It's just sitting out there by itself. It's not some sort of, you know, landscape design for the yard or anything like that. And she's sitting on a chair that almost appears to be like a chair she pulled out of the kitchen or something. It's not really part of, you know, the exterior furnishings or something like this. It's just kind of an everyday glimpse in a moment that you've got your little plant. It's not heroic. She's sitting out there enjoying a nice breeze. I brought in a color picture. It's a little bit easier to see. She's not in it. But the other ironic element, there's a driveway, right? You need a driveway for a suburban house. Where does it go?
Let's go all the way to the front door.
Yeah, it goes to the front door. There's no garage for it to go into. So this is what I mean by he's appropriating the every... He believes or argues that this type of everyday... And I just contrast it with the Farnsworth house here. I think that domesticity... One argument is that domesticity is often stripped out of this kind of architecture of communication. And domesticity meaning just the everyday messy life of living at home, but domesticity can also stand in as kind of an other, something that's not organized or not rational or not part of heroic modernism. So it can mean literally the home, but the concept of domesticity can be broader to speak to these other concepts. But this is much more readable. The Vanna Venturi house is much more readable as a house because it has these tropes that are familiar to folks than the Farnsworth house. This is a glass and steel box again. So it's not legible necessarily as a house to everyday people living their everyday lives. Yet it's ironic. It's not just a house. I think if Venturi did want to just build an everyday architecture, just build Levittown or let Levitt do it, right?
And I like to think that just from the playfulness of Venturi, like even playing with a lot of the classical symbols, I think it's ironic also that he's breaking a lot of classical rules.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, the arch on the house, you know, an arch usually has a center where it holds the weight, but then he breaks it.
Right, right.
And then the usual, like, back at the Gill House, you know, you were talking about the line. It's usually a lot higher. It has like a classical, like connotation to it. But then he breaks it. So I like to think that maybe he's, you know, just saying, at least for during that time when they were practicing that type of architecture, they were just saying that breaking a classical is fine.
Right, and the text I didn't talk about just for the sake of time, but a few years prior to Learning from Las Vegas, he writes a book called Complexity and Contradiction. And so basically the argument is for, a quip from that book is, less is a bore. So if you think of Mies van der Rohe, less is more, he's like, less is a bore. But it's arguing in favor of like complexity, contradiction, borrowing historical sources, but you don't have to do it correctly. You can treat them ironically or humorally. He does an extension in Oberlin onto an art gallery, adds in a wooden Ionic column. It's called the Ironic Ionic column. So the proportions are all wrong. It's in wood instead of marble. So he's very interested in this layered meaning. You clearly read it as a column, but it's not just a classical column. It's got this kind of wit or humor to him. It's transformed in some way. And that I think that makes it all the more complex and contradictory. It's not simply a borrowing from the past, yet it's readable as something from the past. So Charles Jenks would call it double-coded, that it's like a double-coded architecture. So you could read it in multiple ways. It speaks to a broad public, and maybe it speaks to an architecturally trained public. So he would be in favor of this kind of complexity and contradiction, essentially. And then it's legible. The decorated shed is the ultimate legibility. Then they don't, you know, you brought that up. They don't design that many. I mean, you could argue maybe even the Guild House is a decorated shed and that it's got that sign, but it's not, they don't build a lot of, and they admit that actually in the second edition of Learning from Las Vegas, they don't design a lot of decorated sheds. Here's just the Farnsworth House. You can see how like stripped it is of domesticity. The woman who commissioned it, Edith Farnsworth, she was a doctor, and admittedly it's a summer house, like a vacation type house. It's not meant to be lived in permanently, but one of her big troubles, there was a lot of contention during the course of its construction, it was over budget and over time and whatever else, is, you know, where do you put your stuff? Or where do you, you know, one of, there's a whole article written, where do you hang your, you know, nightgown, right? Because as soon as you introduce the flower pot or the nightgown or something like this, it undoes this perfectly rationalized, geometrically abstract environment, which is beautiful, but is not necessarily a readable as a home or livable as a home. So it's not for an everyday life. And one of their big fights involved a piece of furniture that's now here, but it basically, it's almost like a wall divider where you can see over it, but it's a place for her to store her clothing, and he did not want to put it in there because it interrupts the space, but she needed a place. So this is what I mean by an architecture of the everyday that's actually readable and amenable to everyday life versus this kind of heroic modernism. And I love this building. I'm not arguing against it per se, but the Venturis would say that architects need to learn from Las Vegas, learn from Levittown. Learning from Levittown was another one of their studios, and not just simply reject that type of popular culture as lowbrow or kitsch or something like this, but learn from it. And how can architects design buildings for everybody, right? Not just for a certain group of people. And here's the interior of the Vanna Venturi house. So you can see how different it is. It's filled with stuff, right? But Vanna had a large collection of antiques, and so she wanted a place to put all of her like chairs and like this kind of stuff. It would not work in the Farnsworth house, right? So he gives her room for all this. I think the most interesting aspect is the way that different functions of the house fight for space. So you can see there's the fireplace, but it's also like embedded in the staircase, and there's like a window right here. It's not organized in a rational way in the plan. You can really see how just sort of conflated and confusing it all is. In a way, though, what he's indicating is the tendency of people when they're in the home to all congregate in sort of one area, even though everyone goes to the kitchen. We've all had this. You have a party, you lay out a beautiful living room thing, everyone's in the kitchen, right? Even though it's crowded and it's hot and like whatever else, that human life isn't rationally organized like that. And so he almost indicates that by having these different components of the house just mashed together in this confusing, ambiguous, quasi-non-functional way that says something about the messy, confusing, quasi, I guess, dysfunctional, aspect of actually living in a house. So he tries to signify this through the architecture. And here's you can just see how the stairs get so narrow, they're almost, unpassable. This is the dining room. I don't know if you can tell, there's a column here that... Where do you put the table then? The table is forced to awkwardly abut that column. There's nowhere to put it else. But he does it, again, intentionally to indicate something of that messiness, right? That things abut against one another, that life is messy, that you have to deal with that in some way. It's not always these perfectly rationalized scenarios. Here's the upstairs. The scale of this is just difficult. We've got this overscaled window. The doors don't quite fit in the window here because the window is rounded. There's a closet that has stairs that go nowhere. These are the stairs. So they're legible as going somewhere, but at the same time, they don't. So what's knowable and what's not knowable in the architecture, I think, here as well. This is like a second bedroom. The main one is downstairs. So this is part of the Learning from Las Vegas, but in addition, in 1976, Venturi and Scott Brown, they do an exhibit at the Smithsonian called Signs of Life, and I bought this from Las Vegas. I brought some stuff from Signs of Life, but I think this, more than anything else, says something about their theory of architecture as signification and communication. So this is just a generic kind of Levittown type track development, but they point out that things like you've got these curving streets, right, with no curb, and what does it signify? In the bubble, if you can see. Country vistas! There's like a sunrise and there's trees. So even if you see the small scale sort of reproduction of it in a Levittown or some kind of suburban neighborhood, what it calls to mind, what that signifier signifies is the concept of country living, right? Something much grander than what you're actually looking at. It's not literally a country manor. It just signifies something. These are the associations that people call to mind when they look at this. So you've got your yard, sweeping lawn, and people think of this huge, farmland, right? This is a gas meter. It's kind of hard to read in the slide, but it says, shh, pretend you don't see me. I'm not really here, because it interrupts the pastoral beauty of the suburban landscape, right? And people kind of do that. You almost don't notice the, electrical stuff and whatever else by the houses. Trees, and of course, in your imagination, you imagine a forest preserve, right? Even though there's two Bradford pears, right? So, these are the signifiers that we assume is kind of kitsch or something like this, or just everyday and not really architecture, but they do convey broad meaning to broad publics that do have value. Gateway, these sort of little entrances, and you think monumental gate. There's two columns in the entry of this kind of very modest house, and you think the Parthenon, right? So, people add this kind of accoutrements and symbolism onto their houses as a way to express their identity and to call to mind these larger things. So this is part of their point, is that this everyday architecture does communicate. It's not, in fact, a faceless mass that we just drive along. This is the Signs of Life, the interior on the right-hand side. I think I have another. I have the shot of the exterior. But even the choice of furnishings, right? The TV here is kind of a TV encased in, you know, it's meant to look like a piece of furniture. So it's a television, but it's also a Renaissance credenza, right? So people choose these things that might not be architectural. They're just from mass culture, but they convey something about their lifestyles to people. So every choice you make is a communication. This is some shots of the exhibit, Signs of Life. So they basically organize the entire thing like suburban sprawl, essentially. They've got a housing section. They've got the strip is what you see here. The strip is characterized, again, by this complex and ambiguous decorated shed-type architecture, except they don't even have the architecture. They just have the signs. So we've got one arch of the McDonald's. Behind it are columns, which say something about classicism, right? So there's architectural history. There's mass culture. There's a bunch of gas station signs. In the houses here, we've got the Levitt Towner on the upper scale here. I think I just showed you a detailed shot of it. And they're just pointing out that these little balloons, how they say signify. On the bottom here, we actually have a different type of house, the Williamsburg. And I think one thing that's interesting in Signs of Life is, despite the fact they argue this is an everyday architecture for everyday people, and i.e. it's democratic in that way, that it speaks to everybody, it's not elitist, they do distinguish between class in the exhibit. So the Williamsburg is a nicer house for maybe an upper middle class, whereas the Levitt Towner is more of a lower middle class house. So, and they take the lower middle class signs to be the democratic ones of this is actually mass culture. But I think this is very problematic. I mean, who is the public? If you're trying to make an architecture of science that communicates to the public, who is that? So sociologists might say that there is not one public. Certainly at this time, they would say there's taste cultures, and that you usually are speaking to one or two taste cultures. You're not necessarily speaking to the public. So you might be speaking to a taste culture that's very educated about architecture, and they would dismiss this kind of stuff as kitsch. You might be speaking to, you know, a working-class family, and they want their Levitt Town, right? So they want the Levitt Town, or for them this symbolizes something else. So you're not always, the idea that you can choose symbols that would speak to everybody, I think, is also problematic, because there's not a democratic architecture. And I'm just going to jump forward so we can click to the next section. Another problem which we can debate about is, I think, this problem of monumentality. If everyday architecture is just decorated sheds with signs, okay, it's expedient, it communicates, it's, you know, efficient, all this kind of stuff. What about, are there ever instances when we want our architecture to communicate more than just that it's a McDonald's or it's a Walmart and it's efficient and it's convenient? What about public schools or about governmental buildings? How do you have an architecture that expresses those civic ambitions within the paradigm of the decorated shed? And Venturi argues that this would be the most expedient monument. Just a decorated shed with a gigantic, like, blinking sign that says, I'm a monument. This would be the most expedient thing. Would you all like to live in a built environment where the most monumental architecture is this? So I think this is one of the other challenges that many critics bring up, is that the concept of learning from Las Vegas... you know, it doesn't, it's, they deliberately take a non-judgmental attitude. The idea is you learn from Las Vegas, you don't judge Las Vegas, and you take the good from it. But that was also a problem. Even critics in their own time lamented the lack of judgment, right? They just accepts it kind of wholesale. Do we really, and it's an urban sprawl built environment, which I think now, if you've been up to the foreclosure show, for example, it brings to mind all these problems with that land use pattern, actually. So it might be efficient and an effective communicator, right? Architecture of science is an effective communicator, but is that actually an environment that we want to live in? I think that's another sort of question, because it does beget this kind of urban sprawl, which they just leave as, this is kind of okay, right, accepting urban sprawl. I want to just jump forward. I want to show you a really quick video clip. Oh, the ultimate architecture as sign. I want to show you a video clip real quick, and then we'll switch over to Kente. But it speaks to this idea of the suburban sprawl landscape as being one of readable signs that we all read every day, even if it's not designed by high architects. Class, like which buildings are important to locals. What's interesting is that it's by, it's a video done by Ice-T. Some of you might have seen it, it was on YouTube. And basically what he's doing is he's talking about a famous house designed by Charles and Ray Eames, who's a husband and wife kind of team. They design what's called a case study house. It's one of dozens, there's a few dozen case study houses just outside of Los Angeles. And this was a model housing program sponsored by Art and Architecture magazine starting in the late 1940s throughout the 1950s. And basically the point was to design these model houses that were all prefabricated parts, standardized, so they could be models for mass production, basically like tract housing, but they were modern in styling. And so it was meant to be sort of an opposition to a Levittown or something, where it's mass produced, it's standardized, it's a very efficient and modern
way of constructing the houses, but the style of the houses are very conventional. They rely on those tropes that we just talked about, the symbols that are easily readable. Obviously, architects weren't really, they wanted more high design, so it's a case study house that's attempting to do both of those. And I think what's interesting is not only how Ice Cube reads the signs of LA, but how he reads the case study house appropriately to pop culture himself.
A lot of people think LA is just eyesore after eyesore, full of mini malls, pine trees, and billboards. So what? They don't know the LA I know. The good, the bad, and the ugly about LA. The good, the form, the five torches, the Cockatoo Inn, Raleigh Hut, Watchtowers. One man's eyesore is another man's paradise. The bad, the traffic. Each freeway has its own personality. The 405, bougie traffic. The 110, that's gangster traffic right there. It's a difference. You gotta know where you at. Coming from South Central Los Angeles, you gotta use what you got and make the best of it. What I love about the Eames is how resourceful they are. Charles and Ray Eames, a husband and wife team. Before I did rap music, I studied architectural drafting. And one thing I learned is that you always got to have a plan. 2 days to build this frame. 2 days. Got off-the-shelf factory windows, prefabricated walls. They was doing mashups before mashups even existed. It's not about the pieces. It's how the pieces work together. You know, taking something that already exists and making it something special. You know, kind of like sampling. In a world full of McMansions, where the structure takes up all the land, the Eames made structure and nature one. This is going green 1949 style, bitch. Believe that. Who are these people who got a problem with LA? Maybe they just mad they don't live here.
I think what's interesting about that, we'll switch over to Keontae now, but what's interesting about that is that he's reading the environment from the car, right? So the architecture of the strip, right? But there are buildings that mean something to locals. So he points a few of them out, like the Coliseum. They're not necessarily high design buildings, but they do symbolize something to those people. He even can tell the highway traffic, right? You read class even into these spaces. So it's not, and it's very Venturi-esque, I think, that the suburban sprawl environment is not necessarily devoid of meaning or devoid of anything like this. You can read it in such a way. But moreover, he takes this case study house, which, you know, it is a case study house. It never became a prototype for actual suburban tract housing. It was too modern looking, even though it was prefabricated parts, prefabricated steel frame, all off the shelf. I mean, that's all accurate. But it always remained an exception, like a case study house. But now, even he appropriates the exception into kind of popular culture. He likens it to sampling, into rap music, and this kind of thing. And I think that speaks a lot to the intelligence of popular culture as a form of communication to even appropriate its opposite, right? That it kind of sucks it in here. So I just thought this was a very kind of contemporary, I guess, bringing it sort of up to date, the arguments that Venturi was putting forth. And I brought in that apple. We all know apple, but as sort of the ultimate in like a symbol architecture. The architecture is totally dematerialized. So you know that this is on Fifth Avenue, right? So you know that it's an Apple store purely by the branding of the logo. And I mentioned that with the McDonald's, but the architecture of the building is underneath. Actually, there's not actually an architecture. It's just like a symbol of a glass box. It's not actually inhabited. You go down below. To actually go to the store. Okay.
I thought that we were supposed to end it. You want to call it?
I know.
I might go a little over.
That's okay. Here.
Is it for screen?
Right here. Okay.
Okay, I will talk about a little historical period, similar topic, but it's, you know, I studied like architecture history, particularly focusing on like Skidmore, Ismail, the period of massive skyscrapers, which appears actually Freedom Tower, also, you know, Burj Khalifa, the tallest building, Sears Tower, John Hancock, all these, you know, skyscrapers in the United States, all over the world now. They did strange things in the early years. It's kind of a combination of popular culture, communication, architecture, all merged into one special event. You know, when you talk about, like, it's a historical period, particularly 1930s. 1932, we talk about architecture in architecture history. When you talk about architecture history in 1930s in the United States, we normally talk about this event and Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, Pauline Ward, a couple of other buildings. But the international style, you know, the exhibition organized by this institution, we talk about three, you know, main characteristics, like, you know, volume rather than mass, regularity rather than symmetry, all these things. And then, but actually what happened in 1932, I will talk about that a little bit later. You know, there was 1947, there was the builder, a British journal. They talked about this person, very famous architecture historian. He talked about there was a strange thing happened. He talked about, you know, industrial design. In architecture, he talked about industrial designer. There is industrial designer. We architects need to replace them. We need to take it over. Industrial designer got to go. We need to take over their job. We are ready. Strange argument, right? Like how they got together, when, right? Industrial designer is one piece, right? And then we're like our own business. If you look at like history, this is a historical, very important data. 1928, we now talk about like, you know, financial crisis. At this moment, there was a recession, the Great Recession. The construction volume, you can see 1928, right before the Depression, 1932, it became 1/8. So theoretically, the volume of construction became 1/8 during this period. 1932, the worst year in the history of like 20th century American history, that's the worst year. And then that time we talked about international style, bringing in the British, you know, the European architecture, having, you know, we celebrated, right? Even though the economy was the worst, what happened then? There was a public. They got to survive. Many architects became cab drivers, sales people. Many people, like a bunch of architecture offices closed. The famous president of Lee Brothers House was, he went to architecture school, he became architect, gave it up, became salesperson for Lee Brothers. Then he became president. Later he became again architect again. And then he, Madison Square Garden was his work. After, you know, being a president for a while, spending too much money for Lee Brothers House, he was fired and decided to be an architect again. That's his history. Charles Luckman. And this is the situation. So what happened? Industrial designers were super strong. For example, there was Fish and Fowl, both Fish and Fowl, very story. Gentlemen, I am convinced that our next new biscuit must be started by Norman Bell Geddes, the industrial designer. So industrial designer conquered the world, basically. They did everything. They had this kind of evolution of design, Raymond Roy. They even had like, you know, they designed basically everything, pencil sharpener, vacuum cleaner, everything, including buildings, shops, you know, Texaco gas station designed by Walter Doyen Teague. They designed this kind of thing, right? A lot of people thought at that time the issue of the main cause of the depression wasn't overproduction. They thought underconsumption. That's the same, you know, two sides of the same coin. Henry Ford argued that that's an under-consumption issue. So we're stylizing again, not really changing the interior, we change the cover, stylizing it, and stimulating the consumption, then everything will be fine. That's an argument. That's why these industrial designers got these big jobs, worked for all the companies. And then they designed this, you know, everything. Particularly, like, they are not so different, like, still, like, a very well-designed, you can see. The industrial design became like, came to being like, it became really big, 1920s, late 20s, and 30s, they were king. Norman Bell Geddes hired 700 employees that time. There were no like architecture firm that size that time, right? They had their own architecture team. The Great Gordon Bunshaft worked for, his first job was for Norman Bell Geddes, Raymond Roy. So he worked for industrial designer first, and then went to Skidmore. What they did was basically from this like kind of crude machine, creating like a very sharp, like stylized product. From here to there, became really stylized, clean, sharp. And here, pencil sharpener, the industrial designers. Also at that time, they introduced concept of obsolescence. They developed some special technique to make things appear old in a couple of years. Right, when you buy a product, 3 years later, it looks kind of strangely, even though you don't touch it, right? You keep it in a safe, really, you know, not touching it at all for 3 years. 3 years later, you will see it's kind of old because of style, right? Don't you have that kind of feeling? Your phone, there is a performance issue, but the refrigerator, 1936, 37, 38, changing slightly. We don't feel that much difference because to us, it's all the stuff, right? To them, every year it looked slightly different. The old one appeared a little bit old than the new one. So people forced to, the social lifespan of products became much shorter than real life. So there was a stimulating the consumption, right? Circulation, consumption, and facilitating the speed. That's the key. Of course, architects got to survive. Architects learn the lesson. So there is a very famous Norman Bel Geddes, one of the key industrial designers. And then George Howe, who became dean at Yale Architecture School, who designed the PSFS building in Philly. He wanted to team up. So it was announced in Architecture Record, like industrial designer, architect. If you want to see some influences of industrial designers, if you go to the Macro Hill building entrance, right? Empire State Building, the lower level, it's like the three line, the streamlining, that's typical industrial designer signatures. The architect actually took it over. It became particularly strong at the Chicago Fair. And this big shot, they got their building, which is not really modern. They're not modern. They're kind of pseudo-modern, right? And they're like architecture critics criticized the events, the building, done by Raymond Roy, Harvey Kobe, the key like modern architects. They're like not really modern, that's kind of pseudo-modern. And then 1939, New York World Fair. My focus is New York World Fair because it's New York City. We are here. And this is 1939, one of like most successful like World Fair in the world up until now. This is General Motors, Ford, and the aviation building, Twin Towers. So what happened? During the time, it was a key, like the fair was supposed to be like basically school for the public, the general public. They need to learn how to spend money, of course, right? How to use like new technology, how to be more optimistic. They were slowly coming back from the deep hole of the depression. The economy, between 1928 and 38, there was no development. It was between 1938, the economy returned to that of like 1928, 10 years of suffering. So then 1939, your World's Fair, it was like, you need to be more like pumped up, right? You need to spend money buying stuff, and then the economy comes back. So that was like, first opening day, so many people got there. And the architecture was kind of funny too. It was became some kind of industrial design. Previously, sometimes like a wedding cake designer or modern designers did something weird stuff. In this case, aviation building, you see, looks like a kind of William Lasquez, who designed PSFS building, very key modern designer. He designed, look at this building, like kind of airplane. He was surprised as one of the best buildings. Is this building or product or what, right? Elicon is not... yeah, duck. But the duck is like two kinds of duck. First duck was originally very communicative duck, right? In the case of Venturi. Second duck is a neutral duck. Big scale, monumental, but you don't know what the hell is going on there, right? It's like a Crawford manual. You don't know what it is. That's the key. And then it looks also, it got to be boring as well. But in this case, it's like the first duck, real duck-looking duck, right? You can see here, Marine Transportation Building, L.I. Jacquin. Mushinan, very well-known New Yorker, but at the same time, he became professor in Michigan. Very one of the like, key Michigan modern designer. And L.I. Jacquin actually designed a bunch of like wedding cake buildings in New York City. He was a key New York architect, very good architect, very sensitive. But he designed this kind of thing, like for the first time, probably, right? Next one, cash register building, company building. Is it building or product? The number actually represents people who attended the New York World Fair. So whatever you got ticket, the number got up. And then L.I. Kahn, same architect, Walter Doentig, industrial designer, and Haybeck, all together. That's this one particularly, it's not just the one building, there was traveling all over the country. Whenever there was an exhibition, they dismembered, they moved it. So architecture, even this one, Harrison Follow, known architect in New York City, architecture firm, New York City, had a family connection to Rockefeller family. So he got this World Trade Center, not World Trade Center, United Nations. He was in the Rockefeller Center. So here, the Twin Towers looks like industrial object, industrial products almost. And then architecture somehow became kind of industrial object. So Democrat City, Henry Dreyfuss, a very famous stage designer, industrial designer, they designed future city, like not just this one, there's another one. It's called Democrat City, based on Frank Lloyd Wright. Many study Frank Lloyd Wright. And then Le Corbusier. And then kind of image of kind of paternalistic future. And British movie, 1936. Kind of similar idea right there, controlling. And the most famous, like, you know, most popular exhibit was the Futurama General Motors building. There was four separate buildings inside. It was a really, really crazy popular. You could get in. There is a conveyor belt. You sit in there, right? The conveyor belt moving around. You look down, you're looking up, sky, star, and then future city inside. Strangely, this is like role play. Industrial designers play the role of architects and urban designers. Architect designs strange product, you know, product which look like you know, toys, but sometimes project is product itself, but don't look like traditional buildings. So you can see all different scales of site here. These industrial designers, not just like they copied, they studied architecture very carefully. They read Le Corbusier. I mean, contemporary world, and how many students read Le Corbusier, right? So they miss something, I guess. So they read Le Corbusier, but also streamlined. You can see the surface here, the future. I don't know what they're doing these days. And then this is Skidmore's John Moss, that time not S-O-N, same M, John Moss. Moss was an industrial designer. And he, these two guys stole this person from Raymond Roy office. Raymond Roy, like really, or the door, you know, Tegel office. Tegel office, it was the best industrial designer. They took it, this guy, made a partner directly. And this is architect plus industrial designer. And after this fair, he went to a department store, became manager there, like an exhibition manager, product manager. So how does it look like? Radio. It's supposed to be a radio. It's not a building, it's a radio, big size. And then inside there was a like first TV for the first time in New York City, public TV show, Westinghouse. Now it's kind of like a little gone. They got involved during the Second World War nuclear bomb development. But until then, they produced lots of like everyday appliances. This is like a magnetic, plus minus there is a magnetic, you know, and it's coming out. So it's a very mechanical time capsule, which was excavated, which was supposed to be excavated 5,000 years later. Probably if you go to Flushing Meadow, you will find this one. You know, Einstein and Roosevelt, all these people put like some kind of letters for it there. And there is a capsule there. It's they put there 39. And then, you know, this education, right? It's not just a building. You got to teach like one example. This is you got to use machine, then you win. She's a permanently cursed to lose the game, right? She's her name is Mrs. Strauss. So lost game. She's a Miss Modern. So they were like having some like competition every day, a couple hours. Every couple hours they did this thing. So she's smiling all the time. I think probably they changed the roles on and on. And then they introduced this machine. So everything is education, communication. And then popular culture. Also like forming popular culture as well. Because there was kind of like a depressed culture, I guess. So, you know, cultivating like, you know, optimism and then good habit of spending money, which I don't have. Electro, the machine. The Westinghouse mortal man, a 7-foot metal man that talks, sees, smells things, counts with his fingers. Sometimes he appeared with a doll called Sparkle. Robert doll. Really? That's, there is videos. And Wonder Baker House, all these things are designed by Skidmore Owings. And you can see what they did, building. Oh, everything is dug, basically. This one is a Wonder Bakery. This is like just a wrapper. It came big scale. And they had a wheat field on behind the building. this is a kind of little pathetic case, but they wanted to make a hot dog. Didn't work out, so the upside down tugboard putting there and putting water at this indicator. People got it. Sometimes some people, you know, understood it as like hot dog. Some people understood it, tugboard. But why tugboard upside down? And Swift is a meat packing factory, so kind of a strange thing. I don't know, probably that time they had they dealt with the fish as well, I guess. Heinz's exhibit, it's like you don't need actually exterior of the building because it looks like big tomato. So the communication directory, right? But, you know, like Skid Mowings and John Moss later, they argued like their favorite, the best building, this is the best building. But later you can see, strangely, the murals on this side. And there was no door, everything was open. So Skidmore later one time said, this is not really a traditional building, we don't do it anymore. We're doing like packaging. So what is packaging? And then you need to attract people. So this is like an indicator, it's like a neon sign. Building became just like an indicator. It's like a communicator, messaging, bring people in. My point is like during the Depression and after that, architecture, even though we say like, you know, modern architecture came from Europe or these things, but there was just some kind of trace of this experience, American experience, 1930s, the shock of the Depression. You know, you can't think, you know, like your, like let's say theoretically, like the volume of, you know, contract became 1/8 in a couple of years, right? You can't assume there was nothing, there nothing happened, is it, right? You made like $800,000, right, per year, and then a couple of years later, you make like $100,000. There's a change of mentality, right? The whole profession. So even like in Republic, the journal actually proposed like, you know, they want to run on a series of articles to talk about which profession suffers more. Number one, architecture. The first one. But we talk about 1932 international style as if it was kind of pure state of like some architecture going on, European influence, all this level. But fundamentally, there was like, you know, architecture, American architecture particularly, got really deeply involved in public taste and communicating with the public. Less than like, you know, most of European architecture here. Skidmore and Owings send a letter to a department store in Indianapolis. We've been concentrating our attention on the study of the best method of merchandising ideas and products from three-dimensional presentational view. We have had ample opportunity in concentrating our fair work and exhibit work and permanent jobs to study, this is key, the public reaction, how to properly present the product to create a favorable reaction. That's their architecture. You know, there are some keys I'm missing, but that's the point, right? They did a lot of like buildings. They did also a lot of exhibits. Their main focus in the end, their learning was, we know how to draw attention. We know how to create favorable reaction from people. There is not much mystery. It's like science. After that, they did a really like a scientific research. Like they worked with Pierce Foundation. There was a prefabrication research foundation. They built later, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, atomic bomb development project, really massive development project. That's how they became really big fund. But this also like technology and this research on commercial culture combined, they became key to their success. And then 1950s, they became like the SOM became the largest firm in the world. Actually, you know, Gordon Bunshaft, Wharton Edge, all these people. Like, anyway, just going forward. But there's still like, you know, one side we recognize these things, the dogs, right? And you can see this is the toilet house in South Korea. I don't know, I don't see it always. I heard that this is a museum now, but. Kind of weird. Why you make this kind of thing? But probably promote like, you know, better sanitation. I don't know. You feel like there is something would come down pretty soon, right? Oh. water or solid, but and this is Basket Company building headquarters in Ohio. And then this kind of dogs, like, still everywhere. But at the same time, this one, which is like in Park Avenue, Little Brother's house, I saw recently, Casa Libre, there is that they opened a new bar down there. Looked cool. This is like, you know, it's a dog, right? You know, Crawford Manor was dog. This is also dog. And then, you know, it's not neutral, actually, at the same time, right? Like, you know, in the case of Venturi's argument, it's supposed to be neutral, boring. But this is actually company for Unilever soap, shampoo, so cleanliness. So unlike most of like skyscrapers of the time, there is no really frame, it's really flat. So, you know, Dean of Princeton that time called it, there is a fetishism. The flatness is like became kind of fetishism in that building. So this is like, it represents something, right? They try to communicate. It delivers some kind of message. Returning to Venturi, I think Venturi is a final, like, you know, the destiny of Decoy Shared is this one. This is a Whitehall terminal from Staten Island. That's a project in 1995, like probably 15 or 20 years ago. And he wanted to put like a massive screen there. So in the end, like the best, like, you know, signboard is just big signboard, like a neon sign, like it's a, I mean, screen, right? This is a terminal project, actually, like a building project. This is a, I took this photo like a week ago in Times Square. And this, so active communication and merger of like architecture, popular culture, and communication in that situation. Strangely, it seems like architecture is dying.
Yeah, one thing, I was struck by, like, we look at Learning from Las Vegas, and, okay, there's the signs and all this kind of stuff, but they're signs, they're not these kinds of signs, right? They're still signs that are kind of designed, I mean, they might be kind of kitschy, but, like, the Stardust Hotel has little stars, like, twinkling from it, and there's something, I think, we can almost look at those pictures of Las Vegas from 1972 with nostalgia for some sort of, you know, like, bygone modern era in a way. It's not this kind of signs, and Venturi talks a lot about the fact that modern architecture of the Lieberhaus or Mies or something, it references the Industrial Revolution, so structural steel and glass and these new kind of materials, but that it doesn't reference the electronic age, which is newer in the 60s and 70s, of course, but that these signs in Vegas, they started lighting up at that time, and so it referenced electricity. And I'm struck by this because now we would say the digital age, right? And so is the electronic and then by extension the digital age, is it in a way undermining architecture? Is there no need, if it's just about communication, if this build, these buildings are about communicating stuff, but if it is just about that, is there need for architecture at all?
That is a direct thing, because Bob Stern used Venturi's theories when he wrote the guidelines that the buildings had to have these signs, because in a sense, almost artificially perpetuating that mid-20th century idea of signs.
Right.
So
in Times Square.
Because Venturi thought it was a design idea.
Right.
So it's no longer vernacular.
Right, now it's like high design, right? I mean, I think I kind of did it the reverse way with that video, that even like high design can then be somehow subsumed into popular culture, and then the reverse as well. And Venturi, in fact, led, I can't remember the date, but there was an initiative to get rid of billboards at one point because they were, you know, cluttering up the highways. But then he found an organization to, like, preserve the billboards, right, because he viewed them as, but once by doing that, they kind of do become high design, or like the Venturi House or the Guild House. They're not actually quite, you know, is it possible to actually do that? So once you, it becomes high, and then it's no longer low,
actually, Venturi wrote a book about, like, electronic signs.
Yeah.
Electronic period, like, it was probably the late 90s, but it didn't work out very well, because in the end, you have Decoy Shared, and then there's a tiny space behind, right? Then, you know, the focus is this Decoy Shared. Screen is a perfect example. Screen is, like, a permanent, like, you know, millions of, you know, Decoy Shared endlessly producing. So it's like, you know, it comes. And then, I don't know, I think, like, it's communication is good, but at the same time, like, you know, what I want to say is that, like, for example, Frank A. Is it dog?
Like Bilbao or something.
Yeah.
With the titanium.
Also, like, you know, in that kind of situation, it's also communicating, right? It's a symbol. It tells a lot of stories. It's not like a neutral dub. It tells very specific stories, I guess.
And I think it also tells the story of just the essence of our time too. For example, Rem Koolhaas, I forgot the name of the book, I shouldn't, but he was in one of the book about New York, he was talking about Coney Island.
Delirious New York?
Yeah. Delirious New York, yeah. And how he was saying like that was just like the kind of just promoting what New York would be eventually with all the elevators and lights glowing up at night. Mm. And that's just like, if you look at it back then, I assume he was kind of alluding to the fact that it kind of looked like New York now with all the lights and it's just a city. And maybe all these signs are just a promotion of what the future would be and like saying this is our time right now and maybe it'll be something like, you know, in some crazy future where this signs are just everywhere in every city.
Or even, I think, with the digital technologies too, like the phone, you know, that when you have the iPhone, you can have like Facebook and everything on that, maybe not even in terms of what architecture would look like, but even in terms of the scale of the city. So, you know, when you can communicate with Publix just in a dematerialized electronic, like digital way, do you need space? You know, like, do we even need the signs, I guess, is my point, in a Times Square or something like this, if you can just do it kind of virtually, so to speak? So are these technologies going to be the undoing of public life or the undoing of conventional city structures and also maybe architecture even as a signifier? Maybe they can't communicate as well as just that one.
I don't think so, because the idea isn't that new. I mean, there's been the kind of like ludic concept of architecture has been around for a while now, probably for, you know, since the 70s. And it hasn't degraded that much since then. If anything, it's just a small fragment that makes it more interesting than major.
I think like it's like to, you know, wrap it up my presentation, actually, that's it. I wanted to like conclude like this, like something is happening right now, particularly digital architecture. And that there was a somehow I think like Venturi actually expected. Venturi, when he talked about that, they're putting back massive screen, right? We are putting like, I mentioned this thing like in another occasion, like when you deal with a massive scale of building, right? Let's say Burj Khalifa, 2,500 tall building, right? Feet tall, and then or like urban project, right? Massive urban project. But what's the focus? Of course, it's not detail, right? You can't perceive that like that size of details, right? And then it's not space, I think. I guess. Then what's going to be that thing?
It has to be all of those at every different level. You don't only look at it from space. I mean, you experience.
You know, like
architecture isn't a sign in the end because you experience it close up and in the middle and far away and all of them at each level.
I think it's more like from distant view. There is a something, the communication, the not direct communication, not commercial, sometimes commercial, but that level becomes really architecture experience these days.
Like, you're really never going to experience the vast majority of the Burj Dubai in a level of detail. The only place where you're going to experience in a level of detail is in the Mission Impossible movie. Like, the detail of it only becomes important insofar as it can kind of play a role in a movie. Because there's no way to get close to it. You can get close to the inside of it, but unless you're Tom Cruise crawling around it, you can't. So I think you're right that the stuff at ground level, maybe thinking about an urban project, you can think about it on a level of detail. But something that is physical size and that inaccessible.
I also attended like a visit one time like Adrian Smith designing like, you know, Abu Dhabi taller than like Burj Khalifa. And I don't think like they really care about how people experience when they design building, right? That's super, like really taller than Burj Khalifa. It's more like object, like building, skyscraper is an object. It's not like we are like in Wendell Piano Deer Street, Morgan Live with tiny details and then space, light comes in. But this is like 3,000 feet tall building, almost there. Then what becomes the key, I think?
Well, I think the difference you're hitting on, and to get back to your kind of more phenomenological, you experience a building, but like moving through it, and there's sounds, and there's certain textures and whatever else. Because I think, yeah, you're right, that sometimes they're built as objects. They're so tall that it's not about how the humans feel in them. You might feel dehumanized or overwhelmed or whatever it is. It's about the object. But I also wonder if the idea of like a decorated shed, the whole idea of like the strip being okay as architecture. I'm sympathetic to like the reformist view personally that I think that we should be careful not to have everything be strip architecture, actually. And I can't remember the author's name, but he wrote an essay critiquing that. It was called Single Point Perspective, or The Critical Difference of Looking at Pretty Pictures of Hell or Actually Having to Live There. And that's that like experience. So I think that at one point to treat the building as an object or as a sign or this kind of stuff, that's, it might be communicative, but that's in one way, but that's different than you having to go there every day and work there and live there and live in that environment. So, which I personally think is a kind of era. I mean, I think that architects have a social responsibility to deal with like how we live
in
the space.
And that.
I'm like revealing my personal sympathies, but I'm a little critical of the idea that architecture is only a communication, like a sign or something. I think it's a space people live in, and it does have the potential. It can't on its own change society, but I think that it has a responsibility to try to make it better or something. So I'm, you know, that's my little personal.
I think contemporary architecture is really about like, you know, they talk. I think like asymptote or like Frank K. All these people, when they do like deal with the digital technology, the key is, first of all, we still believe new technology might provide us some kind of new exit or new territory. That's the main reason, I think, a new expression, right? Second, you know, it's much more efficient, you know, like BIM, BIM, all these things. But at the same time, something is missing, right? So my point is like, you know, somehow these are returning to architecture as an object or architecture as a communication tool, but at the same time, I mean, just simply, it's like, let's say, it's kind of irresponsible, but something is dramatically changing.
Right, well, like the Starkey technique.
Also, it's so oversimplifying. I mean, the jury is disserviced in if you're trying to characterize any building as a shed or a duck.
Right.
Yeah.
Is the Disney Center a duck?
I mean, right, I actually had that in there, and I cut it out just for time, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think even things he would characterize as ducks, like Lieberhaus that you brought up, or like the Seagram building that I brought up, they're not actually ducks. Like Lieberhaus actually does signify something. Like the Seagram building with those bronze I-beams, I mean, that is not a duck. That is signifying something. So I think they unfairly dismiss pretty much like all of that modernism, that kind of high modernism, as ducks that aren't worth looking at, which I think is oversimplified. I mean, I completely agree. They do signify something, actually. So,
But still, like, you know, it's really, like, I feel... there was some kind of desire to find some kind of American context of the period, 1960s, particularly, like, you know, Venturi. Like, you know, if you read, I asked them, like, I assigned the student to read this period, and then I asked them how they felt, and not really giving any kind of context. They really loved this the book. Like, they thought it's just so American, so democratic, so open. But at the same time, the result looked, like, pretty bad, right? I mean, like, we have building this hospital, massive hospital, Venturi, Scott Brown built like in Lehigh Valley. There is like big hospital. The design, key design, is this H highway. You see H, right? The H highway sign that's like in front of the building. The massive H, that's it. I mean, there is a different quality, of course.
But their best work really came more out of complexity and contradiction.
Yeah,
I think of the Sainsbury
I think
more out of the classical. Tweaking
the but I don't know whether it worked really well, because like to play the game you need to understand classical as well, so-called ordinary doesn't work very well, you know. That's a complex contradiction.
Yeah, that you brought that up, that it kind of requires an architectural education to understand the Venturi house, for example, right? You have to know what those things are supposed to mean and know that that's not what they're actually meaning. And so, I mean, I think in that sense it's not every day. It's actually the very elitism they're allegedly against. I mean, I guess we have to kind of wrap it up, but my concern, the reason why I brought that Apple store at the end, I think what you're kind of trying to get at is that not only maybe architecture is more becoming an object, like it's just only communication or it's a fetish object or something like this, but I think the other aspect of it is that it's not even just about the sign anymore, it's about branding, and so like an experience economy. And so when you see that Apple store with the Apple, it's not just that you can easily recognize what it is. I mean, automatically you know that, but that they sell lifestyle in there. They don't just sell iPods. And so even your experiences are commodified as like these consumer, and Disney is the exact same thing. You go in there and you're buying an experience, and you can go to Epcot and visit the world in like one little place, but it's these signs of the world. So if you go, I went recently, and you know, Africa is represented as a whole, not the individual countries, and they actually had like a thatched roof hut kind of thing going on in there, and it just does not at all speak to the complexity. So it does communicate, but is it actually communicating in a meaningful and like way? So I'm very like skeptical of like the experience economy and architecture's, I guess, complacency and like participating in that, and like Disney and all that kind of stuff. But I do think that's kind of where, I don't know, stuff for better or for worse is going.
I heard there's actually a lot more get to that spatial branding.
I heard there's an important exhibition going on, Foreclosed. I think that's very meaningful at this moment.
Yeah, the Foreclosed. It's a critique of the suburban, the strip, basically, and we'll also Levittown, I guess. If you guys haven't seen it yet, the Foreclosed, Rehousing the American Dream.
Yeah.
It's kind of a critique of that land use pattern. Because obviously now we wouldn't, the strip has become, since 1972, has become, you know, more.
Thank you for your patience.
If any of you have questions, we can stick around for a few minutes.